Describe the musical influences while growing up in Napanee, Indiana.
Well, actually, it was a small town of only about 3,000, but I had a wonderful piano teacher who came over from a nearby town and started me at 4 years old, and she was really great, and that's the reason I have a lot of piano skills that I do now. And then my parents would take me to a concert series over in that town, Elkhart, where a lot of the music instruments are built, and they had a really nice concert series. So I heard good music from a real early age.
Were your parents musicians?
Yes, my, well, more or less, amateurs. My dad sang and enjoyed choir experiences and everything, and he's still singing at 96. In a thing. So it's, you know, it's like a lifelong musical experience for him. And my mother was a pianist and quite good, so they encouraged me a great deal. And in addition to that, I had a really good high school band director who was real important in my encouraging me and getting me into playing the horn. And I played pipe organ in our church for 3 years in high school, and then my folks sent me to Interlochen National Music Camp for a year, for a summer. And then the last thing I did was play in the South Bend Junior Symphony for a whole season when I was a senior. So actually I had a lot of good experiences even in this little town. And so.
When did you start playing the horn?
When I was a freshman in high school, I was 14 years old.
And did you play any other musical wind instrument before then?
Well, he sent me home with a piccolo, thinking maybe I could play that, and I couldn't. I could not even blow it without fainting. And so I took it back, and he said, well, the only other thing I've got is a French horn. Would you like to try that? And he said, let's see, you play piano, don't you? And I said, yes. And he said, well, then you can probably handle this, all right. I took it home. It was a love affair from the first minute I blew it. Oh. But I never had any instruction about how to. It's just sort of like take it home and try it and see if you can blow it.
Did you have any private lessons throughout your high school years?
Yes. Yeah, that was another important thing, too. I went, but it was with a trumpet teacher, and it was, again, over in Elkhart. And but he was really good. He was very good on breathing and getting a free blowing sound. He used the WHO technique, W-H-O-O, so that I didn't use any tongue for a long time, and then on my warm-ups anyway, and then changed to using T-W-H-O-O, so you blow two, and it was really good, very excellent kind of training, so yeah, that helped.
Did you find that taking from a trumpet player gave you a different embouchure than you wanted? Did you have to change your embouchure at any time?
He didn't have me change it. He was kind of, you know, really walking on eggs, trying not to do anything too detrimental to a horn player, but there weren't any other horn teachers around, so he was good, and he just taught me as much as he could about brass playing.
And did you have recitals when you were younger on piano and
yeah.
or horn?
Mm-hmm. Piano, my cousins all took too, and so sometimes we played duets and trios, and you know, laughed uproariously at these funny things, and they were all really sociable experiences. And I did some horn playing, too, but I don't remember as much of that in just an occasional recital, but not much, so. Mm-hmm. Mostly in bands and orchestras.
Okay, so after you left high school, you went to Oberlin for your bachelor's degree. Can you tell me how many women were in the brass program when you were there in 1947?
You know, I tried to remember when I first got there, and that's, I can't remember for sure when people came, but I would say within, you know, those first years that there were probably one or two trumpet players. I can't remember any women trombone players. There were a couple of horn players and one tuba woman who came. And I mean, she was the first tuba woman player anybody had ever seen, you know, and she insisted she wanted to get in the marching band, and they had never had any women in that, so you know, she had a little trouble with that. But actually, I don't know that it was just the band she had trouble getting in. But then she did play in a couple of orchestra experiences, and she was very good.
I wonder what those women are doing today.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know.
Track, yeah.
Yeah. How involved were you in the vocal and the piano departments at Oberlin?
Actually, not at all in the vocal department. In music education, you sort of had to do a little bit to learn how to teach it, but that was all I ever did. I didn't really do any other special things with that. But the piano, I studied for 4 years with a wonderful Italian lady who was very patient with the fact that I didn't practice a lot because I wanted to play the horn so much. But she encouraged me and really got me to do some wonderful literature. So.
And what was her name?
Mrs. Lytle.
Lytle.
And so that was, you know, those were the most things I did with that. I did a lot of, my horn playing was took most of the time. I played in Gilbert and Sullivan productions, which they had every year, and lots of chamber music, and just, you know, I was so busy, extracurricular, I almost didn't have time to go to school.
Did you play any piano recitals?
No. Okay. I accompanied, though.
Okay.
I did accompany several, mostly singers. I don't remember doing too many instrumentalists.
And you took horn lessons from Martin Morris.
Yes.
Can you describe him as a teacher?
Yeah, he was, I tried to think about him and what my reactions were. He was really excellent at orchestral excerpts because, of course, that was what he was doing all the time. And he used to write out a lot of them by memory. And I still have some of the sheets that he wrote out so, because if he couldn't find something, at that time we basically had just the Potting books and not much else. And so if he couldn't find something, he would just write it out. And he was a very quiet man and very precise about everything. He wasn't a terribly good technique teacher, so I didn't really improve technique-wise, I don't think, during those 4 years, outside of just the fact that I was playing a lot. He was real good on musical ideas and interpretation, and at one point he offered me this chance or told me about the chance to go to Aspen, but I turned it down for financial reasons as many as other things, but now I regret it. I wish I had gone. Anyway, he was a very good influence, though.
And what was Martin Morris's position?
He was second horn, and that was absolutely his career. He was really proud of being second horn, never had any desire to do anything else, and he talked about that, playing low horn, as being something that was really important and that you could just concentrate on that and become really good at it. And he was very good at it.
Do you think that a horn player could do that today, concentrate on just low horn?
Oh, I think they could, sure.
And have a career?
I think that most of them don't do that, but I don't know why not, because, yes, I don't know. My son has played a lot of second horn because that's what he got into in Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, but he still loves the chances he gets to, like, play first horn in the LA Opera or something like that, and I guess, you know, all of us like to kind of get those chances once in a while, but.
So how did you meet your future husband, Art Becknell, and what musical interaction did you share at Oberlin?
Well, let's see. I don't even remember when we met, but the first time I became aware of him was when we were riding the train from Ohio back to Indiana, and he would talk to me and set my bag off, and so I realized he was in school, and then finally we got well acquainted after a while because we were both in music education. And we were just very good friends for most of the 4 years. We didn't start dating until the end of our senior year, actually. And so one of the first things we did together was to sing in a madrigal group the summer after we graduated with Robert Fountain, who has been here many, many years, but he had just come to Oberlin to be the choir director. And so we had a wonderful time singing with him, getting to know him. And so that was kind of the beginning. Then we went to teach, and he taught in Wisconsin and Marshfield, and I taught in Midland, Michigan. Actually, I taught in Ohio first. But there was this big lake in the middle, so we didn't see each other a lot, except when we went home to our parents' homes in Indiana.
And how many years was that while you were apart?
About 5 years.
5 years. Now, going back to Bob Fountain, was he influential in bringing Art here to study at University of Wisconsin?
No, actually, Art was here before, long before he was.
So. Okay, so there was not a connection there.
No. You were going to ask about some major performances in
right.
Oberlin, and it was funny, but just this morning I remembered one, which was the Bach B minor Mass, which is pretty daunting for any horn player, and I don't remember if I was a junior or what, the first time they decided to do this in Oberlin. And so there's, of course, just this one piece is so hard, and the old conductor named Maurice Kessler suggested, he said he had heard someplace that if horn players would run up and down and get, you know, just get their respiration and their circulation going really strongly and then go and play, that their body was slowing down and then they wouldn't be nervous. And so he wanted me to try that. So I did. This was in a chapel, and you could do this down in the basement. And then I came up during a bassoon piece or something right before it was time for me to go, or right before the piece. And And so it really worked, actually. It kept my nerves from getting very much in the way. Of course, you were slowing down enough that you weren't still panting or anything, but it was an interesting idea. And I played it later with the same group in Cleveland, and it didn't work quite as well, but I didn't have enough space to run.
Did you feel shaky?
No. If you wait long enough, it was like I did it, and then I came up and waded through a piece, and my body was still just kind of slowing down, but you feel so energized. So it was an interesting idea, but that I still remember that, and that the performance went quite well for a first time on it, and it's a really hard piece to play.
That's very interesting. Can you think of any other performance experiences while you were there?
Oh, just, you know, the regular ones that were orchestra experiences, and I did a solo recital when I was a senior, a half a recital, and that was kind of interesting. I don't think I played terribly well, but it was kind of unusual for music education people to do that, because you didn't have to. It was just an option.
Right. What do you have any other memories of your undergraduate life that are not specifically musical related? I mean, what was your undergraduate life like?
Oh, Oberlin was a small town where you had to make your own entertainment, and the nearest town was Cleveland, and so we would go in there for concerts sometimes, and particularly when the opera was going on, we'd go in and we'd sit up in the farthest distant place. I just remember this was a huge auditorium, and you had to take your field glasses so you could see the stage, and those were kind of fun. But in college, oh, there were lots of activities that went on. I remember that some of the political campaigns, there was one where somebody was named Mr. Green was running for one of the campus offices, I think. So there was a rainstorm, and the next morning we got up, and somebody had put green food coloring in all the puddles all over campus. So it was just, there were crazy things, and the students were great at just making wonderful times. We had good dances and good entertainment things, and lots of stuff.
Now, when you left Oberlin and you went to teach in Michigan, how active were you as a horn player while you were teaching in the public schools?
I was real active. I almost killed myself. I played in the Dow Symphony, which rehearsed once a week, and then did fairly frequent concerts. And then I drove to Saginaw, which was about a 45-minute drive, I guess, and played first horn in their orchestra. And they had a pretty active season and quite a lot of rehearsals. One of the main things that I remember about that was that there was an old German conductor whose name I cannot remember now, but he used to call me Nancy Dolling, and I was sort of one of his most popular people, and so the string players I rode with used to give me a terribly hard time about that, but that was really fun. He was a good musician, and it was great. But you know, when you teach 5 days a week and you run over there or play a Dow Symphony rehearsal at night, and so you don't get quite enough sleep and everything. I used to have to sleep half the weekend to get caught up.
Dow Symphony, D-O-W?
Right.
Was that from the chemical company?
Dow Chemical, right.
Oh, they sponsored an orchestra.
Right, they did. It was actually a community orchestra, but Dow, it was called the Dow Symphony, and I think it was because they were the principal donors, and they provided space and stuff for us. Or at least I guess they did. It was all interconnected at any rate, and it was a kind of a good amateur orchestra, but I guess in retrospect it probably wasn't so terribly good.
During those 5 years, did you take lessons with any horn teacher?
While I was at Midland, just in the summers, but not during the winter time, but that was when I got my master's during those years, and I would just go summers to Northwestern University, and after the first summer, I found out that if I continued for 3 more summers, I would have my master's. And I thought, well, this is really easy and really fun. And so I did it, which is a wonderful decision. I was really glad I did. And especially because Max Potteg was there for the first 2 years, and he was a wonderful influence. And then he was retiring from Chicago Symphony, and Phil Farkas began, and so I had him for the second 2 summers, so it was really an opportune time to kind of see the changing of the guard there.
So describe Max Potteg as a teacher as opposed to Phil Farkas's methods.
I don't know if I can do it as opposed to, but I can tell you about them, you know, just sort of. Potteg was he's a very charming man who was kind of an old world type and was very conservative, and just a very beautiful person who was really interested in his students and I thought a wonderful musician. I really got a lot of out of studying with him. There were some students at that point that were already, you know, kind of chafing at the bit. They wanted to get Farkas and everything, but of course he was, Prodig was new to me, so I really enjoyed him. Let's see, I was trying to think what else I wrote down about him. Oh, he worked on increasing my range and etudes and excerpts. He was good at technique, so I finally started getting some of that. At the same time, I also met Carl Geyer. I mean, another person who was like Max Prodig, an old German man who was just a charming, very gracious, very lovely, quiet person who was just a terrific man to know. And I bought my crispy horn from him in 1956, I think it was. And he had imported it, and then he built me a mouthpiece to fit it, you know, so I had to go in and try all these little mouthpieces so that he could decide how to do it. And it was really wonderful, you know, that he took that much time and he was really very careful. But I regret greatly that I didn't buy one of his horns, which I could have done at that time. But I was sort of poor, so I'd use all my money I saved from teaching, I'd use it all up in the summertime and going to school and going to concerts out at Ravinia, and then I'd go back and I'd be poor and work another year. So
your master's degree was in performance.
Right.
And so you performed a graduate recital?
Yes, and that was after I started with Farkas, who was a very different kind of a teacher. He had a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of personality and a much more comprehensive approach to the horn, because he had just finished his book on the art of horn playing, and so he had me work out of that and gave me a copy of it. And then we worked a lot on the Gallet Unmeasured Preludes, and I remember how particular he was about the musical quality of it, and he liked very much what I did with it. I still remember he talked to me about that years later, about, you know, well, you were the one that I'd give those to, and when you'd come back, I didn't really have very much to say. That was funny, because he said a lot, but of course his recollection was he didn't. So anyway, he was wonderful, and going out to Ravinia to hear him play in the Chicago Symphony was really a wonderful experience, because he was a very careful person about his warming up, and he would talk to you for a while, and then he'd go off by himself, and he'd carefully prepare whatever excerpt it was that he was going to be playing that night. You'd hear him practicing it and getting it exactly the way he wanted it, and when he went on stage, he was very precise. The way he had practiced it was the way you would hear it, and musically and every other way, it was really beautiful.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm sure you were very lucky to have studied with Max Prodig and Phil Farkas.
I think so. It was a fortunate experience.
So when you gave your, getting back to your recital, how was your graduate recital? Do you remember what you played?
They actually let me just do a half a recital. I don't remember. I think it was because we couldn't find enough time. So a singer and I did one, and we did the Auf dem Strom together. And I did a piece that was new. It was the second performance of it by Edith Boroff. Now it's you know, in standard repertoire, but at that time it was still in manuscript. And my husband, or who was not yet my husband then, but Art was supposed to play for this recital. And he was planning to, and we had rehearsed together, and then Edith Boroff decided she was going to come, so she came and played for it. But she had such a strong touch that they told me that they could hardly hear me. So, but anyway, it was really interesting to have the composer there.
Okay, do you have anything else to add about life in Evanston?
Well, not too much. That, you know, it was just being there in the summers. I didn't get much feel for the campus life. There were so many women teachers that would come back there in the summertime to get their certification or something, that they called the dorms Menopause Manor, because they were mostly older women that were back there, and I was probably one of the youngest ones in the dorms in the summertime. But it was, you know, it was kind of fun. We had a good time, and I remember I have some friends still that I keep in contact with that I met there, including Marvin Howe, who was a horn player that was real instrumental in a number of things, and helped me later on in my career. For instance, he proposed me for membership in the advisory board of the International Horn Society, so it was a nice friend to have had.
Okay, so let's leave the graduate school for a minute and talk about your relationship with Art. You met Art at Oberlin, and then you continued to see each other over breaks or when you could while you worked in Michigan, and then
then, I don't know, we finally decided that we didn't like the single life, and so we wanted to get married, and so we did in 1956. And it was, you know, it was a wonderful relationship that we had all these years of just music and fun and everything, and I was accused of marrying my accompanist, you know, which is, it's always a good plan anyway to have. Except he was so busy, a lot of times we didn't have time to really practice together. But.
So what were the inclusive years that you taught at Midland?
I went there, I taught 1 year in Ohio before I left, just on, I taught everything from first to 12th grade, vocal music, instrumental. It was, and I was traveling to about 3 different schools. It was really a horrifying job, so I hated it so much I thought I would never teach again. And then I took this job in Midland that sounded a little better, and it was fun, but it was vocal music, and so I wasn't really very good at it. I just sort of did it, and I was very anxious to get out of it. So when I came here, I had determined I would not teach that kind of thing again, ever, ever, ever. And so it was 1952 to 56, and then in the summer of 56 is when we got married.
Okay, that's what I was trying to figure out, is how what happened between Midland and marriage. Mm-hmm. There was nothing between Midland and marriage.
Right. It was finish in June and get married in August and start right up here. And Art paved the way for me to do things here by getting me a job as, it was part-time work supervising student teachers for the university, which is very nice. I still have some wonderful friends that were the student teachers that were in there, and they were mostly vocal people, but it was really a great experience to do that. And then he also got me the position as first horn in the Madison Symphony. I mean, it's nice to get one that way, isn't it? You know, just somebody recommended you and said, oh, this is, she's really a fine horn player. And so he says, oh, great, we need that. And our first horn player's just left. So I never had to audition. I just walked into the first rehearsal, and I had it for a lot of years.
So. That's great. So you obviously have been very career-oriented as a professional horn player from an early age. How did your relationship with Art affect your career plans?
Well, I really wanted to be a professional horn player. I wanted to be in an orchestra. And while I was still in Midland, Phil Farkas called during the middle of a year, told me there was a position in the Boston Pops open, and asked if I could go and do it. And I thought about it a bit, but you know, it was hard to leave that teaching position, and I wasn't sure if I really wanted to do it. You know, it was sort of not exactly what I thought I wanted to do. So I turned it down, but then after that I sort of regretted it. But that was the main change, that I had thought that when I finished my master's that I would really try and get a professional playing job. But instead of that, then I came here, and of course I had a wonderful time in Madison Symphony, and that grew more professional as years went by, but it certainly was not when I first came at all. And it was probably a good decision, though, probably better for me overall. But that was the main thing, and otherwise I think I probably did a lot more professional things because of Art, because of his encouragement and the business of being here in a big university.
So. That leads me to my next question, in that you married August 19th, 56, and Art was finishing grad school here. And at that time, can you remember what your outlook was on life, what you thought your ideal life would be?
Well, I think at that time I wanted to be married, and I wanted to have children, and I wanted to teach privately, and I wanted to play my horn. And, you know, it was pretty easy to do all of those things here. In fact, I had probably up to 15 private students during the years that my kids were growing up. And it was most of, when they were real young, I had to have babysitters. But after that, they would take care of themselves. And if they needed something, you know, if they were bleeding or something, they came and got me while I was teaching. But otherwise, they sort of took care of themselves. And it was a nice thing because I was at home and available. But so that was kind of a nice thing to be able to do. And then Art was, he tried to be home the evenings that I would have Madison Symphony rehearsals. So we didn't have to have too many sitters, but actually we had a lot of them. And I think it got to the point where the kids would say, well, who's coming tonight, even if you weren't going out. So
right.
It was, but they survived very well. So.
So your forecast of the ideal future is pretty much what happened in your life.
Yeah.
That's great. It's good to
right.
know.
I mean, outside of the fact that a few times I would look back and think, oh, what would have happened if I had really gotten into a professional orchestra and played. and sort of, you know, I had a few regrets about that at certain times, but really I think that the fullness of the life here was enough to more than make up for whatever I might have missed in that. So.
Okay, you accompanied Art on his graduate recital. What other types of musical events did the two of you share?
Well, I tried to think about that. I mean, it was mostly church choir things. I played for the church choir, and he would conduct it. And then, I don't know, he accompanied my recitals numerous times over the years. It seemed like we did a lot together, but I can't remember specific things. It was just that we were so involved in a lot of things together, and we would, whatever the experiences were, if one person did something, you'd go and either listen to it or be involved in it or whatever. So we did a lot of things together, but those are the main ones I remember, were chamber music and recitals together and so forth.
In 1960, you helped form the Cadenza Club, an organization of faculty and faculty wives at the UW School of Music. What was that like, and what became of that organization?
Well, I couldn't remember much about it, so I had to enlist the help of Lois Gilbert Anderson. And she reminded me that it was Mrs. Burns' idea. Now, Mrs. Burns was the wife of the chairman of the school at that time. And Dr. Burns was one of the reasons that Art came here to school. He had been chairman of the music education department at Oberlin. So we had known him. And when he came up here, then Art, I think, because he was here in Wisconsin, decided that this would be a good place to come for his master's. And so we had known them quite well. And Mrs. Burns decided that the faculty wives, there weren't very many women then, I mean it was like faculty wives was basically it, needed a social way to get together so they would know each other, and also that it would be kind of a service club for the School of Music. So we occasionally provided tea and cookies for receptions or things like that, and then we would have programs sometimes. And I don't know, we'd meet several times a year. I don't really remember exactly how many times. And I don't remember exactly how that word Cadenza Club came about, but I remember that we chose that and we all laughed a lot about what, you know, how to make a name for it. It ended while Dr. Burns was still chairman. And I think it was mainly because the women were having other interests. There was a lot more going on and they didn't really need it so much. But the women and the faculty wives at that point were, if they were performers, it was sort of like they weren't to be seen too much, you know, as far as being really involved. It was not a possible thing as it became later. I never felt that very much because after I came, I was so active in the music, community music circles, in music clubs, music in the Madison Symphony, and then just gradually kind of got opportunities at the university because they, in many cases, they didn't have anybody to do what I could do, and so I think I just gradually began to get into that kind of job.
So you're saying that the School of Music didn't really encourage the faculty wives to perform?
Definitely not.
Because, right. Why do you think so?
Well, she thought that there was somebody who had misused the privilege, you know, said that they worked for the School of Music and, you know, really didn't or something. And that might have contributed to it, but I think it was just a leftover from the male-dominated music society, music world that had gone on for a long time, and not necessarily a prejudice against it, but there may have been some prejudice, and there certainly was in many places, but I don't really know, but it definitely was there, that it was a long time before the faculty wives were really allowed to do much at all and were appreciated for what they brought to the school.
Speaking of being faculty wives, how was it like for you to be a faculty wife, especially once you yourself became faculty in 1971?
Well, I don't remember too much about, you're talking about just after I became a faculty member or whatever.
Right. Do you feel that you were treated any differently because you were married to another faculty member?
Probably not. No, I don't think that had much to do with that. I thought people, you know, I really have only positive recollections. I thought I was treated really well. Maybe my attitude had something to do with about it, because I always looked at it as a wonderful opportunity and as a just kind of a way to serve the community and everything. And I wasn't really trying to do anything special for myself, but I don't know. It was a really good opportunity in the faculty. I don't remember. I had some things written down. Let me see what I put. Can't really remember it. But I have only positive experiences to remember about the way I was treated as a woman, and I don't remember ever being feeling that I was different than the men. I just looked at myself as a horn player who happened to be a woman, and instead of a woman who had to kind of prove herself, and I think I was treated that way all the time here. I can't say the same for the rest of the world, because sometimes when I would go other places, I would feel the prejudice and the fact that they would lump women into a category rather than look at you as an individual.
So do you think that this area of Madison and this school of music, you would say, is progressive during those years as far as accepting women?
I thought they became so, yeah. It took some time, because I would say when we first came, it was not that way, but I think in the maybe 15 years after that it did become that way. Pop that thing off.
Okay, let's go back to some of the reasons why you chose the career you did.
Well, I was remembering that when I went to Oberlin, I really wanted to be a horn major, because that was my main interest. But my dad felt that women particularly should get an education degree as an insurance so they could get a job, because at that point there were very few, if any, women in symphony orchestras, and they were mostly flute players and harp players. And so it was probably very good advice that I should do that, and I suppose he didn't want to support me the rest of my life or something. So I did get the education degree, but that was a very prevalent thinking at that time, that women particularly needed to do that, because teaching was open to them as a career, but you were not so sure about professional playing or anything.
And your dad funded your education at Oberlin.
That's right. He paid for the whole thing. Insisted on it. I worked a little bit in the summers for some spending money, and other than that, he didn't want me to work there or do anything. It was wonderful, because he didn't really have that much money, but they sacrificed a lot so I could do that. So I was an only child at that time. Although, well, I have a brother, and he was going to. I was an only child up until the time I was six, and then I had a brother who wanted to go to college, but he didn't have as many aspirations as I did. So I think his education didn't cost as much. Going to Oberlin was really expensive. But then I paid for the rest, the master's and stuff.
So I'm sure that because your dad was paying for Oberlin, you sort of felt committed to get that education degree, because that's what he wanted for you.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I can understand that. All right, let's backtrack again and go forward in time to the UW years. When you first got here, did you work with the Summer Music Clinic?
I occasionally did, yes. I can't really remember how much I did with that. But I taught a number of times. I remember doing a chamber music session, or a coaching session, and the fellow who is now the bass clarinetist in Madison Symphony was there as a high school student and playing. He was absolutely great. It was a wonderful, wonderful ensemble, and I was so impressed with him, and he's done really well. He's not a music musician as a profession, but he...
What is his name?
Greg, can't say his name.
I don't know it.
At any rate, he was really good, very impressive. But I did have a lot of good experiences, and I did teach horn at the clinic a number of times over the years.
Can you, just from your observation, describe what the Summer Music Clinic was about then?
Well, it was conceived to give high school and, I guess, junior high kids an opportunity to have some special musical experiences with really fine conductors, and to give them a little bit of enhancement for their high school education. And here in Wisconsin at that time, there really were no other opportunities like that available. So the music clinic here was the first of its kind. Now there are a number of them around the state and other places, but it was, you know, people who couldn't go away to Interlochen or someplace like that had an opportunity for a couple of weeks to really have a very special experience. So I thought it...
Okay, and when you got here, John Barrows was here as a horn teacher.
No, when
no?
I got here, no.
Okay, when did John Barrows come?
19, I don't remember.
63?
Yeah, probably, okay. 60s, yeah.
Describe John Barrows.
So, describe John
Tell
Barrows.
Tell us about him.
Whoa. Well, physically he was a tall, very well-built man who was, you know, he was just a very imposing person, the kind of person that you were focused on. When he came in the room, he simply, you know, you couldn't not be aware of John Barrows any time. He had a wonderful way of telling stories. He was very, very funny. He could also be very caustic, and he had strong opinions about everything and everyone. He was a wonderful cook. He loved good food. He was a tremendous inspiration musically for the students, and they flocked here. He just had a way of inspiring people to do more than they could have ever done. When they heard him play, when any of us heard him play, we were so inspired. It changed your whole outlook of what music could sound like. And many people said about John that he was such a musician, it wouldn't have mattered what he played. If he had played the baritone, or if he had played the cello, which he did at early parts of his life, or if he had played piano or something else, he still would have been a great musician. You would have heard the music first, and secondarily, the instrument he was playing. But he finally settled on the horn, and he had a wonderful technical control. He had beautiful pianissimos, gorgeous sweet sounds, power when he needed it, just a fantastic interpretation of everything I ever heard him play. And I heard him do a lot of things that are still unforgettable for me. One of them was a performance of the Scriabin Romance, which is such a little piece. I always thought it was something you'd maybe give to intermediate people. And he played it for a women's group at the president's home, and with Tate Barrows at the piano. And it was such a gorgeous performance. I thought, that's the most beautiful piece I think I've ever heard. And later I heard him do the same thing with the Beethoven Sonata, which was not a piece that I had ever liked terribly well, but it was so beautiful the way he played it. Just was such a melodic concern, you know, instead of being punched out or something. It was really great. And then when he played in Madison Symphony, he played, I heard him do Till Eulenspiegel. And again, unforgettable way that he conceived of that solo, and changed my whole concept of it.
So when he came here, he started playing in the Madison Symphony?
Yes, pretty early, yeah, he did. We kind of shared the first horn. When he was available, he did it, and when he wasn't, I did it. And so it was a fun experience.
Did you play second to him when he was playing first?
I think I did most of the time, and third part of the time. It kind of depended on who else was in the section, but that's my recollection. I'd have to go look at programs again.
So John Barrows got sick around 1970, 1971, and you started playing in Wingra at that time.
Yeah, actually, I'd been playing in the brass quintet before that. I was trying to look up the dates. But I did start playing in the brass quintet before I played in, I think, let's see, can't remember which I played in first. I think I played in a brass group. I don't know that they call it the Wisconsin Brass Quintet. Then I played in the Wingra Quintet, but I think that was even before John came, and then played in the brass quintet again, and John came and played in the woodwind quintet, and then when he got sick, I took over that. Temporarily, you know.
Do you remember the players in that brass group that you first played in?
The first one. Well, Don Whittaker was the first trumpet, and he was instrumental in getting it together. There were a number of different second trumpet players, all of whom were in grad school or people who were close. Barry Hopper, who taught at University Whitewater, was the person who probably did it the longest. And Bill Richardson, after he came, was the trombone player, though before that there were some townspeople that had played in the group. And we had a series of tuba players again, so I can't really...
And who were some of the founding members of the woodwind quintet, or when you were here?
Well, actually, when the first woodwind quintet here, which had Barrows in it, was Bob Cole and Harry Peters and John and Dick Lottridge, and who did I miss? The clarinet player,
Glenn Bowen.
Right. So that was the first really the quintet that stayed together and that really was called the Wingra. They took the name of Wingra. Before that, it had just been kind of piecing together wooden quintets, and that's, you know, I had played a little bit in those. They were trying to get something started, but they didn't really have faculty people to do it.
So when you came into the Wingra after John was sick and then passed away, describe what Wingra was like. How many performances per semester, or how often did you rehearse, or did you have tours?
I think we rehearsed two or three times a week, but I don't remember for sure about that at that point. And we usually played one campus concert every semester, and then we toured a little bit, maybe three or four concerts out a semester or something. It wasn't a lot, and we often just did things in this area. It wasn't real well organized, though they had some different people that planned that. But it was an awesome chair to fill when you sit in after, you know, Barris has been there. But I was, at that point, I was really excited, very confident in my musicianship, and I wanted to learn, and I just, you know, I was just hungry to do everything like that. So I don't think it ever occurred to me that I couldn't do it or something. I just couldn't wait to get into situations like that where I would be with good players and be challenged and try to see how much I could do, you know, how good I could sound, how much improvement I could make. So,
do you think that you did make improvement?
I hope so.
Through Wingra, it helped your musicianship?
Oh, yeah, through everything. I mean, just by playing with good players and learning. I mean, I didn't take very many formal lessons with John Barros. I did one semester, have quite a few, and otherwise, I mean, it was trying to learn from him a lot. It was a real important part for me. But I learned as much by just listening to him as I did by actually, you know, picking his brain about how he did things. And he couldn't always describe it very well. I mean, technique was not to him a terribly important thing because it was really natural for him, and I don't think he had to work on it a lot. So he was more concerned about everybody being great musicians and, you know, working hard and everything.
Now, when did you begin to teach lessons at the UW School of Music, as well as playing in Wingra?
After a year or so, or maybe a year or two after Barros was here, he had a couple of chances to go on tours with the New York, I think it was the New York Brass Quintet first, and then I think later it was the New York Woodwind Quintet. And they would tour out in this part of the country, and so they got him to go along on them. And so I would sub for him for maybe 2 weeks at a time while he was off on those tours. And so apparently I did a good job, because when he would come back, he apparently talked to the students and they were happy and everything. So then the next time he would be gone, I'd get another job, you know. And so that was how it started. And then after, when he got sick in the late 60s or something, I guess, when he first started having his trouble with Hodgkin's disease, and he had to take some time off, and I would teach for him or play for him whenever he wasn't able to. Then he took, when he was in treatment for that, he took a year off and went to Tempe, Arizona. And so then he asked me to teach that whole year, which was really a wonderful opportunity to do. It was kind of tough on me because I've, of course, had family, and I was trying to play in Madison Symphony, and it was a really heavy year to do. But
do you remember what year that was?
Let's see. I think it would have been around 1969 or so, 70, I can't remember, 70. It's around that, you know, beginning of the 70s probably.
Do you remember any particular students through all these years that were exceptionally talented or whose careers have been exceptionally successful?
Yes, I was thinking about a whole bunch of them. It was wonderful fun to think about them. When Barros got sick and I had to take over his part of the job, then the part of the job that I was kind of doing at that point, Jay Waddenpool he was here as a grad student, and he wanted to study with Barros. He actually had very little time with Barros, and had me instead. I don't pretend that I did much for him, except that we did a lot of wonderful music together. And so since then he has gotten into the Boston Symphony Orchestra, plays often in the Boston Pops. You see him on TV, and a wonderful player. He's been third horn and associate first, and just done a great job. So he's one of my fondest memories of great students. And then good experiences, whether it's been at a summer clinic or the kinds of teaching they've had, or the materials, of course, are really good, or recordings. They've got so much access to recordings. So I would say there's a lot of difference in that. And I was thinking, too, about, I think at one point you asked me a question about what it was like to teach some of the really fine students, and I was thinking about the fact that most of them taught themselves, and that's sort of the difference. I mean, sometimes you have to really help students motivate themselves and design their things, but with all of these people that I was mentioning who have made great careers, they generally would set their own goals. They would be hungry to learn. They would decide what they wanted to know, and you'd just help them figure out how to get that. And I think that's sort of an example of how highly motivated students and ones who are really going to go somewhere, they have inside themselves this hunger for learning, and they know what they want to find out and what they want to do and how they want to get their skills better, and then they just go about finding it.
So what aspect of your teaching position did you enjoy the most, and why?
That was hard for me to think about because if I had to pick out something, it's probably the student and faculty contacts that are just, you know, the high point of doing the job. But it's hard to say. I love the time in the brass quintet because I was in that a long time. I love the time in the woodwind quintet because people are wonderful and the musicianship was so good. And the students over the years have just been great, and I still have a lot of contact with them. So I don't really know. When Doug came, he brought a lot of discipline and the expecting people to practice more, expecting people to achieve more, and bringing them a lot more ways to influence their lives, more recordings, more listening to concerts. Just, you know, he really expected a great deal more. And so I think after he came that for all of the students and for me, in other words, we had to make some changes just to adjust to this the new expectations and the way that he was designing horn program.
Okay, and
I enjoyed horn fundies too. I mean, most people wouldn't like that, but I love teaching that.
So. You love teaching the fundamentals class,
yes,
to the music education.
Right, right.
Non-majors.
That's right. We do horn fundamentals. We can't call it horn fundies so much. I forget it has another name now.
In 1982, you developed the team talk curriculum of the brass pedagogy class. Describe how that curriculum came about.
Actually, I only did the undergraduate one, and Doug developed the grad program, as I understand it. Probably was in conjunction with the others. But it seemed at that point that we needed a course to help students to learn how to teach the horn. And along with Jerry Olson, we developed this course, and it was interesting to look at all the materials that were possible, and then to devise, you know, just a, sort of a syllabus for that. But it didn't last terribly long. You know, it seemed as though we didn't need it quite so much after they made some other adjustments in the curriculum. So only the grad one has persisted.
Okay. What were some outstanding musical events or visiting musicians on the University of Wisconsin campus throughout your 20 years and plus here?
It's hard to remember all the ones, but the ones that stick out in my mind are the Stravinsky Festival that we had when Robert Kraft came and conducted the faculty orchestra. And that was just a wonderful experience to see Stravinsky's music through his eyes and find out his expectations for how short Stravinsky wanted his staccatos and things like that. And that was a really big moment. And then when the New York Brass Quintet was here and the New York Woodwind Quintet were here, those two experiences I thought were real high points for me because we were able to play with them. Oh, and there was another time when the Chicago Symphony was here and their section came and did a kind of a master class, and some of us were able to play in the section with them.
The horn section?
Yeah, and that was a really fun time. Doug arranged that, but
do you remember what years these things happened? Stravinsky Festival?
I cannot off the top of my head. The Stravinsky Festival was quite a long time ago. New York Brass, I can't remember if they were here maybe twice over the years or something. And the New York Woodwind Quintet was here just fairly recently, within the last 5 years, I think.
Right. So when Doug Hill came to the university, he played in the Wingra Woodwind Quintet, and you played in the Wisconsin Brass Quintet. And then at some point, you decided to switch places. Can you describe why?
Well, it was Doug's suggestion and choice, because he was feeling kind of remote from the brass faculty, which, of course, for a horn faculty person, is the, you know, the core of where you kind of make changes and devise solutions and all that kind of thing. And we didn't really have regular meetings as a brass faculty, and so Doug just felt like he didn't have any way to communicate regularly with them. And he also wanted the experience of playing with them after playing in the Woodwind Quintet for quite a long time. And so he suggested it and wanted to do that. And so we, I don't remember how many years ago it was now, 7 years or something ago, we switched places. And I went back to Woodwind Quintet playing, which I had done before, so it didn't seem really strange. I had done quite a lot of the literature, but so I don't know. It's just it takes a little time to adjust to a new way of blowing and fitting in and of thinking and everything. But other than that, it was a nice opportunity. So, and I got to go to Alaska that first fall. So,
you liked it.
Yeah.
Okay, describe any personal insight you had as a 50% faculty member on the development of the School of Music as a whole. Did you feel limited or free in your position as a half-time lecturer?
Well, I felt pretty free. Doug at one point wanted me to go up for a tenured position, you know, to see whether we could do that at a 50% lecturer. And I sort of made the decision not to try for that. I don't remember why I didn't want to do it. And then they just continued to renew my contract until I was retired last year. But other than that, they pretty much gave me free rein to do what I wanted to. So if I wanted to develop a course like the brass pedagogy, that was all right. I wanted to have a newsletter that would go out to all the alumni to try to gain some more alumni interest and communicate with them. So when I talked to Dale Gilbert about that when he was chairman, he let me go ahead and organize that and change the format of it. They had occasionally done it before, but so the Music Accents alumni newsletter came into being.
So I knew you were editor of it from 1979 to 1985, but I didn't realize that it was your brainchild.
It pretty much was, because they wanted this to happen, and I was really concerned about it because I thought that we were missing the boat in terms of getting money and alumni enthusiasm and everything to bring back to us. And so when I talked to him about it, he said, well, I've just been thinking about it, and I think I've got some money that we can do this with if you want to be the editor. So I did it. It was great fun. I had been an editor when I was in high school, and you know, I always liked to write and everything, so it was a really good job. So those things, and the times that I, like with Ellen Burmeister, we planned a seminar on relaxation techniques, and I pretty much felt all the way along that anything that I wanted to do as 50% faculty member was all right, that I didn't have any, I was never treated as less than a faculty member, which was really nice. And at 50%, you also get all the faculty benefits. So I had, you know, it was a wonderful job.
But that's great. What was it like to be the only female brass player and teacher at the School of Music? Did you feel any different?
I don't really think so. You know, in the beginning, I realized that I was, because I would always be in a group, like a brass group or something like that, and be the only woman in it. But that's all right. It was good. You know, I kind of enjoy that. As far as being the only female in the, you know, kind of on the faculty in the beginning, which was really true, there weren't very many around in the beginning. I guess I didn't really realize that was sort of a beginning, a way to get started in having women on the faculty, and that maybe it was a test case, and if I had been a flop, maybe they wouldn't have been so eager to hire a woman later, I don't know, but at any rate, it always seemed kind of natural to me, and again, I just looked at myself as a horn player who happened to be a woman, but that, you know, I was a musician and a horn player first, and that seems to have made the thing easier to, you know, to fit into that kind of a setup. But
good. Can you describe your involvement in the International Horn Society?
Well, due to Marvin Howe, who proposed me for advisory council membership, And that was how many years ago? I don't remember, but you probably have the dates down somewhere. So I became advisory council member, and then they asked me to become the secretary treasurer. So I did that for 3 years, and it was on the advisory board for a total of 6 years. And the whole experience was wonderful. I met many, many people and got to know people well from other countries and ones that are in leadership roles in that organization, and also some of the wonderful performers that otherwise I probably wouldn't have known as well or wouldn't have known at all. And I thought that was, it was really important. I still think that was a marvelous experience. And the job as secretary treasurer was quite challenging at times. Sometimes it took a lot of time. And particularly at the time when we were trying to find a new executive secretary after Ruth Hokanson resigned, it took a great deal of time. We did some of our interviewing over the phone, and you know, it was just, it was a very heavy period of work. And so, but it was really wonderful. I'm glad I had an opportunity to do it, and I would do it again.
Bill Richardson told me that you and Art were good friends with John and Mary and Patton.
Peyton,
okay. Right. Were they on the faculty here?
John was. In fact, he will be here next week, as a matter of fact, doing something at Edgewood College, and he and his present wife, he's not married to Marion anymore, but they'll be here and stay with me. So they're okay. Still very close friends, and I see them periodically. Art played for John, and they were enormously good friends. Art was the best man at Marion and John's wedding, and used to play for Marion and for John. They did a lot of duet recitals, so. And I hope to see Marion this summer, too.
John Peyton was a singer.
Right.
Right, okay.
And so is Marion. They both are singing, though they're coming sort of to the last parts of their career, so they don't do as much, but they still are both actively singing.
So you keep in touch with both of them?
I do.
And where are they now?
Marion is in Germany. She's been teaching over in Germany for about 3 years or 4 years, and has a nice job in Regensburg, and so I may go and visit her this summer. But very, very special people, very, you know, great warmth and depth of musicality. And John has recently edited a lot of Italian art song that he found the things in libraries and edited them for performance, and has made quite a name for himself with that. And that's the reason he's coming here to talk about that.
Okay. Can you describe the School of Music's response to the student uprisings of the 60s and 70s, and especially the Sterling Hall bombing?
Well, you know, it was interesting to think back about all that period, because I remember the times when Friends was over on University Avenue, where there used to be the Walgreen drugstore, and the students had broken all the windows, and everything was boarded up, and it looked like some kind of a bombed-out place for quite a long time, and it was really kind of frightening to, you know, for instance, to start down the street, either to go home or whatever, and you'd look way down, and you'd see this huge quantity of people coming. They would be having a protest rally or something, and so you'd really get away from it pretty fast, because you didn't have any idea if it was going to be violent and they were going to be throwing things or whatever. And the mall area was just full of everyday, you know, protest stuff. And some of the School of Music students were involved, but I would say relatively few of them, for the same reason that is probably true now. They are so busy trying to get their skills and their craft going, and they pretty much are focused on music, and they don't seem to need so much of that outlet. Now, sometimes they would take part, and they would go out and try to find out what was going on, but I never felt that the music students were really heavily involved in most of the protests, and though some of them felt strongly about it, I think they were less involved than a lot of the other students. And I don't really remember much except after the Sterling Hall bombing. I think everybody was so horrified at the loss of life that pretty much the air had gone out of this push, the balloon of trying to protest so violently and everything. So we never had so much after that. But that was kind of interesting, and I remember too when they had I think it was a teaching assistant protest, and I think they were coming trying to get more money, so they were picketing the buildings, and they picketed this humanities building, and so you crossed this picket line every time you went to work, And sometimes they were kind of rude, and they were, you know, it was a little bit frightening to cross this line, very militant line of people, and you didn't really enjoy this kind of thing much. And of course, we got a lot of national publicity, so people would call and say, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" You know, we hear these terrible things. Well, in general, you could come, go to work, go home, and not see much of what happened except the many, many broken windows and so forth, and that kind of violence. But it was kind of a scary period, so we didn't see much of it. It was generally limited to, like, the Capitol, the State Street area, and some areas around campus. But other than that, it was not all over the whole city.
Okay. Do you think that the School of Music faculty had any sort of response to everything that was going on as a whole?
No.
They pretty much tried to just stay out of it?
I never really saw too much of that. Occasionally people would try to get us to sign statements or do something as a unit, but there people had mixtures of opinions, and so it was hard to get a real consensus. And I would say that was very true in School of Music as well as everywhere else.
Okay. Let's talk a minute about Art and his role at the School of Music. He started as a graduate assistant, and then he did some choir work, and then he did some accompanying and some teaching of pianists, and also Dalcroze Eurythmics. Mm-hmm. Can you describe basically his role in all of these?
Well, when he got his master's here, he did it in vocal music, and so he was heavily involved in the choral department, so they got him to conduct the men's glee club, so that was his involvement there. I think he also did some classes and that, and did a lot of work for quite a while and with the choral department. But of course his main skill was probably piano, so he kept that going and did a lot of accompanying. I don't think he taught piano for a long time. I mean, it was mostly accompanying, teaching that and working on it. But then when he was getting his doctorate, we were hunting for some kind of a subject for his dissertation, and decided finally that a history of Dalcroze Eurythmics in the United States would be a really good title, and they accepted that. And so after he worked on that, then he wanted to get his certificate so he could teach Eurythmics, and he did, and they allowed him to teach it here, and so that's how that began to get in. And then later on he began to teach piano as well as
a Where did he get his certificate to teach it?
New York Dalcroze School.
Okay.
And his doctorate was from Michigan.
All right.
So, and he did a lot of chamber music stuff over there.
So he taught Dalcroze Eurythmics for maybe 20 years?
I would say.
You'd say? Okay. Describe briefly what Dalcroze Eurythmics is.
It's something we both had at Oberlin as freshmen, and it's the use of the human body to learn rhythm. Because if you only learn rhythm as something that you count and you see notes as separate, there's something lacking in for the performance of music. So Dalcroze Eurythmics attempted to teach people expressiveness, connection of musical lines, the experience of doing two beats against three beats, or whatever, just complicated kinds of rhythms that you internalize by acting them or moving them with your body. And I mean, that's about as close as I can get, I guess, to a description.
And Art was very involved in Dalcroze. He really liked it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Loved it. And he was involved. He was president of the National Dalcroze Society for a while, and, wow, and did a lot of workshops around the country, and usually taught at the National, National Conference, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Art would have wanted to be a dancer at some time in his life?
Oh, yeah. He did want to when he was in high school, or thought he wanted to, but his parents sort of took a dim view of that because they thought boys didn't do that, and so they turned it off. But he, as many times as he could, he played for ballet classes and sort of, he would do all kinds of things. He learned to tap dance and learned to do certain kinds of ballet, and so he sort of worked out his frustrations in other ways.
Well, what other instruments did Art play besides piano?
He played viola and percussion, and those were mainly it. He could hit the highest note on the horn you ever heard, but that was the only note he could hit. Other than that, he didn't do any particular playing.
Did he perform on viola?
Yes, in the Madison Symphony for quite a while. And he also played percussion there for a while. I can't remember what exactly, but not drums, but usually something, bells or, you know, whatever.
Okay. What would you say were art's major contributions to the university?
Well, getting the accompanying program started was certainly the one that he was probably most proud of, and beginning the Dalcroze Rhythmics, and over the years just adding that to the richness of the curriculum. I think that those were two of his big things. He enjoyed his accompanying greatly during the years, particularly when John Payton was here, and after that when he did a lot of accompanying for the singers, because I think he enjoyed that more than, well, I don't know, until he got started with Bill Richardson and John Ailey, and then I think he enjoyed his instrumental playing just enormously, because the three of them and their the Brass Ivory Trio, that was probably his most enjoyed thing in recent years. It's just the performing he did with them. He admired them both so greatly, and they had great times together.
Okay. We've talked a lot about the School of Music at the university, but we haven't talked a lot about the community of Madison's musical events. What can you tell me about that?
Well, over the years, they changed pretty dramatically. When I first came, we would rehearse every Monday night for Madison Symphony, and then after about, you know, a month or a month and a half of rehearsing, you'd do a concert. And it was very amateurish. You know, there were just a lot of people in there who didn't pick up their instruments except when they went to the rehearsal. There wasn't too much else going on. The Union Theater had a fairly good series of things, but it was nothing like it is now, and that grew over the years. And we, of course, we didn't have a Civic Center at that point. So after the Civic Center came into being, then the cultural events just mushroomed, and we had many, many more. There were a lot of music clubs here, several music clubs. Those were quite active, and SAI met, and they were pretty active. So there were a lot of things like that going on in the town, but as the orchestra got better, too, there were more events with the Madison Symphony.
Do you remember what any of those music clubs' names were?
Well, Schubert Club was the one that I was a member of, and there was a Federated Music Club and a Euterpe Club. Those were the main ones that were active, I guess. So, and some of them were performing clubs, and some of them, I think the Federated Club was maybe more that they would bring in outside performers or something. I don't think they performed themselves.
Okay. Let's talk about the future a little bit. What are your plans for musical development now?
Musical development. Well, I plan to practice the piano as much as possible. There was something that really had to take a back burner all these years through horn blowing, because I didn't really have the time to. And I've tried all year to really take time to learn some new music, and haven't succeeded much at that. But I have played the piano quite a lot. I do sort of some gospel and hymn jazz things, and I do that for fun. But also I've played for the Gilbert and Sullivan Group. I've played for the Madison Symphony Chorus. I've done a bunch of pop sessions that, you know, people get me to do because I do it so easily. It's just sort of as easy for me as, I don't know, cooking or something. You know, it's nothing very, very difficult. So I really enjoy all of that. But I am hoping to do some more practicing. When I heard Howard Karp play last night, it just reinforced my desire to work on some Bach and some Chopin and just really dig into that literature. As far as the horn's concerned, I deeply, deeply want to play at least one or two seasons with John Demain, the new orchestra conductor, and I look forward to that very much, and hope that I can physically and technically stay strong enough to be able to do that up to my expectations, because it's not fun if I don't do it well, because I still hear in my mind what it should sound like, even if my body doesn't always do it.
So. What do you see as the role of the UW School of Music now, and what do you see as its role in the future?
Well, I think it's been for quite a long time a real leader in the country and the state, and I would hope that that is going to continue and perhaps grow even better. We think that with better publicity, we probably could bring in better students throughout the country. But I still feel that the School of Music should primarily focus on the students of Wisconsin and probably neighboring states like Minnesota, where we have that reciprocal agreement, and try to to just improve their musical skills and abilities, try to prepare better teachers for the school so that we then are fed back better students in the future, and I think those things are really important. So I guess that's what I see. I mean, I think we also need to prepare our professional musicians, but it's a fact of life that there aren't that many jobs, so we have to be careful about how much of that we do.
Right. And how do you see the typical horn student changing in the years to come?
Well, I think they're just going to keep coming better prepared. They have so many opportunities now to play in, like here in Wisconsin, the Honors Orchestra, go to music clinic, be involved in listening to records, having better band programs in schools, having opportunities to play in recitals and all kinds of, Wisconsin Youth Symphony, I mean, that's just an immense resource. So kids are very, very fortunate, particularly in city areas. So I don't know. I think they're going to also, when they come to the university, they're going to be very cautious about their job choices. And in fact, I was just talking to my senior student, Krista Finley, yesterday, and she said that she's not sure. She's definitely coming to the university. She definitely will be in music, but she's not sure if she's going to double major or whatever. So there's going to be this kind of thing where they maybe need to maintain more options with their careers.
Because less and less orchestral spots will be open.
Right. People are sticking with those orchestral jobs now. They don't move around very much, it seems.
Well, I guess we're pretty much near the end. Can you think of anything else that you want to add about your life here in Madison or music in Madison?
I can't think of anything. I think we've pretty much covered all the things. I guess we didn't say too much about my great love of the uses of meditation and relaxation in terms of music and health. I mean, it's because of the health problems I've had. I've used that a lot in that way, but I also think it's enormously important in terms of music to learn progressive relaxation and to practice the principles of relaxation and meditation and so forth.
How would a person go about doing that?
Well, there are lots of good books on it. So Benson has written several things about relaxation, and those are really helpful. They explain in great detail, but there are many books about it now, so mm-hmm. It's not too hard to come about, but mm-hmm. but that's been a real interest.
Also, I know that your church and religion has been a very big influence on your life and on
Absolutely.
Arts life. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, it's probably, it's the thing that for us, personal relationship with Christ has been our main focus, and therefore, I guess it's probably changed our lives and changed the focus of our lives a lot. And I mean, it's not like something that you can put aside and say, well, this is your musical life and this is your religious life. I don't believe that's true. I think that my religious life is me, and it's part of what makes me what I am, and it's part of every daily life. So, yeah, it changes enormously all your decisions and all your outlook on everything. Get you through the rough times and so forth. So, mm-hmm. That's been pretty important.
Okay. And anything else you'd like to add?
I don't think so, but I thank you for doing this.
Sure.
It's been fun, and you're a very fine interviewer, I think.
Thank you. It's been a great interview.